Welcome, everybody, to Health, Wealth, and Divine. My name is Juwanza. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope everybody's staying cool because it's a hot one. And speaking of hot, hot show lined up for you today. For all of you entrepreneurs and budding entrepreneurs, you know why you've tuned in today. You know the resident professor, Professor Joseph T. Geiger, author extraordinaire. He's got over 50 years experience as an entrepreneur. That's right. You heard me correct. Over 50 years experience as an entrepreneur. So you know that the information that you're going to get today is information that's born out of wisdom and is tried and is true. And we're going to tell you how you can get the book. It's called Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top 105 Business Principles. This book just keeps growing and growing and growing, and it's up to 105 business principles. And again, for all of you entrepreneurs out there, you know, if you've been in it for a while, that all kinds of things come up when you're an entrepreneur, things that you just never thought would come up, things you never planned for. And this book, okay, will take you through step by step, going to hold you by the hand and walk you through some of the different principles that you will need to implement in order to be successful as an entrepreneur. You know that over half of all new businesses started fail within the first year. That's an astonishing figure, okay? And so you want to stack the odds in your favor, right? So that's why you need this book, okay? My special guest today is the author of the book, and it's, again, Professor Joseph T. Geiger. And in case you've never heard of him, I'll tell you a little bit about him. Currently retired, Professor Geiger grew up on a Kansas farm and graduated from the School of Business at the University of Denver. And over his lifetime, he has started over 10 businesses, two of which predated his college graduation. And after the second retirement, he taught entrepreneurship and small business management at J. Sargent Reynolds Community College, which is located in Richmond, Virginia, and we're just so blessed to have him as my special guest again today. Professor, welcome back. Great to have you, as always. Looking for another powerful show.
Thank you very much for having me.
No problem. You know, even as I read your bio here, again, you started two businesses even prior to graduating from college, which is very interesting to me because obviously, you know, when people enter college, they're going hopefully with the desire to obtain a degree, either a bachelor's degree or, if they want to continue their education, a master's and continuing on up through a doctorate. But you actually started two businesses prior to graduation. Did you know that after you had started those two businesses, even before you graduated, that entrepreneurship was the road that you were going to take? I mean, because, again, starting businesses while you're still in school, again, that's a lot of people, they might go to work for somebody while they're still in school. I mean, and, of course, we have recent examples of people that actually started, you know, businesses in Facebook, you know, for example, Facebook and others while they were still in school. But back then, you know, did you have any idea that entrepreneurship was going to be your path once you started those two businesses?
Well, I didn't when I started the first one because I was in high school then, and my dad wanted me to take geology because he wanted me to get into the petroleum business, and petroleum engineering at the time was not a class, but people who were interested in that field took geology, and I did that for the first year I was in college, and decided that that just really wasn't for me. It's not that it is, frankly, today it is the most lucrative non-medical degree that you can get. It is far and away the most lucrative bachelor's. As a matter of fact, in bachelor's, master's, PhDs, MBAs, all of those, a petroleum engineer can expect to have a far higher earning than anybody else. I don't care whether they have no degree or a PhD. Unless you're in the medical field, that's the only field that outstrips petroleum engineering. But at any rate, he wanted me to do that, and it just really wasn't for me. So I transferred to University of Denver's business school, and then was interested in business. Although at the time, the word entrepreneur was really not in the U.S. lexicon. It may have been in the French lexicon, but it certainly wasn't in the U.S. lexicon.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting that your father was ahead of his time. You know what I mean? I mean, just when you look back, I mean, just thinking back to all those many years ago, I don't know if the statistics were readily available. I mean, of course, we can get stats at, touch of a button now with computers and
mm-hmm.
technology. But for him to know or to be, you know, steering you in that direction, and then all these years later, you know, over half a century later, to find out that the very field that he was steering you to would have ultimately ended up being the most lucrative non-medical field that you could actually get into. That's uncanny.
Yeah. Well, we lived in Kansas. We were on the farm, and he had some acquaintances that had looked at our property looking for oil. There wasn't any, or at least they didn't think there was any, but he got to know them anyway. And the income potential there had been very high. It is still very high today. I have people telling me, well, with the decline in the cost of raw petroleum per barrel, that it probably won't be. I tend to disagree with that. I think it will continue to be. It is such a commodity that's a very, very fundamental commodity to the economy of virtually every country, whether they're an emerging country or they're one like we that are a very sophisticated country. Having access to oil and therefore to energy is kind of where it's at. And if you look kind of ahead, there does not appear to be anything that will replace oil in the foreseeable future. There's talk about things, but I frankly don't see it.
Well, everybody, again, you're in for a wonderful hour. So just buckle up. Make sure that you're taking notes. And again, we're going to be telling you how you can get the book. That's the purpose, so that if you're an entrepreneur, that you can have at your disposal information, years of wisdom born out of experience that you can use so that your business can be successful and you don't have to be one of the, you know, fatal statistics of one of the businesses that fold within the first year. So we're going to help you to ultimately reach your successful goals. Well, again, my special guest is Professor Geiger. We're talking about his awesome book, Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top, 105 Business Principles. We're going through the book, principle by principle, chapter by chapter. And last month, actually 2 weeks ago approximately, we started in a new chapter, chapter 4, which is how entrepreneurs view financial statements, financial statements. You do realize as an entrepreneur that you are going to have to view financial statements, right? There are some things you're just not going to be able to get around. And so we're going to start this show with the principle, you are broke. You can't make payroll on Friday. You are broke if you can't make payday on Friday. Well, Professor, so what if somebody says, well, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say technically I was broke if I can't make it on Friday. I mean, you know, what if I have the money on Saturday, you know. Your response?
Well, if you have the money on Saturday, you're going to be highly damaged. If you have the money the following Wednesday, you're really going to be damaged. And if it's any further off than that, what happens when you can't make payroll on date required is that your good people suddenly understand that you're in financial difficulty. That means that they're in financial difficulty and they start looking for other employment that is financially more solid. If they're good people, they're not going to have any trouble finding it. Right today, there are more jobs out there for people than people looking for jobs. And so if you're a talented person and you're working for the XYZ company and there you figure out that they have financial problems, you're not going to have any trouble finding other employment. You really aren't. And you probably aren't going to have any trouble finding other employment at a higher salary, because that's generally the way it works. You go to your prospective employer and you say, well, I'm kind of burnt out there and I'd like to find another place, but actually I'm making $8,500 a month, and I certainly wouldn't be interested in moving for less. And what's going to happen, they'll offer you 9.9 or maybe 9.5 or something like that. So you skip. What happens is the business that is in financial difficulty really needs you, because they really need their good people, there you go. So if you're the owner of the business and you can't make payroll when it's due, you're going to lose your good people. And what it does, it means that the less talented people are going to take over, and things aren't going to work out quite so well. So you really need to make sure that you can make payroll on Friday. Now, how do you do that? Well, you plan. That's how you do it. And you plan what your expenses and your income is going to be. In order to get that, you need to do a business plan. You need to do a business plan every year. If you're smart, you'll do a three-year plan, and every year you'll update it for the next year and make it a three-year plan. You try to forecast how you're going to do every month in the first year and every quarter in the second and third. The same thing is true of a cash flow forecast every month and then every quarter. And every year you take the coming year, which you've already done in quarters, you update it and you put it in the months, and you try to make sure that you have all the expenses and all the income. And what my experience has been is it's a whole lot easier to forecast what your income is going to be, because you tend to overblow that a little, and it's really easy to miss the expenses. Normally, a business has a limited number of income sources and a much larger number of expenses. And what happens is you pick out the big expenses and you don't miss those. But what you do miss is a whole bunch of little ones. And there's $100 here and $500 there, and pretty soon you're talking about several thousand a month. And it's, oh, goodness, we're in trouble. So you don't want to miss those. And what I did is once I learned to do this, then I would, once a month, I would take the coming month and break it down into weeks and go through it in what will happen in the coming 4 weeks. And so what are the income sources? What are the expense sources? Are they realistic? Have we missed anything? And if you do that and you follow it through, you probably will never have a time when you're short on your payroll cash. And what happens when you're short of your payroll cash? The other thing that happens is that you start shorting payments of other kinds. And so it snowballs. And once you start doing that, you're digging yourself a hole, and you're going to have to figure out a way to stop digging and start filling. And sometimes that's very difficult to do.
And, you know, there are no excuses that are good enough for the employee who's being told that his check is not, you know.
Yeah, it doesn't make any difference. What you're going to find out is that when you own a business, you're the last one to get paid. even during good times, you're the last one to get paid. So you pay everybody else, you pay all your bills, you pay your taxes, you do all of that, and then if there's anything left over, well, then that goes to your supposed salary. And I say supposed salary because you should set a salary for yourself, but you may or may not make it. And if you don't have the cash to pay all your other bills, well, then you don't make yours. It's that simple. So you got to make sure that you can make them. And as you say, Juanza, if I don't care what the excuse is, it is not anywhere near good enough for your employees. If you can't make it, there are no excuses. Absolutely. It's their money.
And, you know, I was going to say what's interesting, too, is that the employee who is about to find out that his employer doesn't have the money oftentimes won't find that out until payday. It's not like the boss is going to warn them, like, on Wednesday, hey, buddy, I just wanted to let you know. it doesn't look like we're going to be able to make payday on Friday, you know, because the employer may still be holding out hope, still praying for that miracle that something's going to work out and the money's going to be there, you know. So, of course, he's not going to warn the employee, and the employee doesn't find out until payday. And in the back of the employee's mind is the fact that he's thinking that the employer knew that the money wasn't going to be there. And like you said, he's not concerned about the bills, of course, that the employer has. And, of course, if it's to that point where the employees aren't getting paid, then the employer obviously has some serious stuff going on and some serious weight on his shoulders that the employee couldn't even imagine, but nevertheless doesn't care.
But they don't care. I mean, that's like telling somebody that it cost me to produce this product. It cost me $10 to produce it, so I have to sell it for $20. But somebody else can produce it for $5 and they're selling it for $10. The buyer doesn't care in that case. And the employee does not care that you're having difficulty, that you haven't been paid for 2 months.
Right.
And that your house is, the mortgage on your house is closing in on default. They couldn't possibly care less. And quite honestly, they shouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking about somebody who was at it for 60 years. So they shouldn't care. It's not their concern. It's your concern as a business person that you pay your employees. And when you say, well, they think that you did know up ahead of time, unless you're an absolute bonehead, of course you knew. It's just you thought you could somehow
right.
pull it off, but of course you knew. So don't think you're going to kid yourself on that, because you're not, and you're certainly not going to kid yourself on your employees. And furthermore, they often think that you're getting paid. It's just they who are not getting paid.
That's a good point.
And they think that. And you can swear up and down or do whatever you want. They're not going to change their minds. They're going to believe that that's the case. So it really, things spiral downhill in a very big hurry. And turning those around, like you say, even if you had the money on next Monday so you can give the paychecks or you can do the direct deposits, nowadays you don't even have a float. Years ago, when you paid everybody with a check, you had a small float. Although I have sat in my office when we could dial up our payroll account and watch it go down. And if we had an account, well, there was a time when I had over 100 employees, so I could I might have $25,000 in that account, and I could watch it go down, bing, 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 as they showed up at the bank to
right.
cash their checks. And that was not during a time when there was any worry about their being paid. It's just that at that time, people were on a cash basis, and a lot of them did not have payroll accounts or you know, personal checking accounts. Nowadays they do, but it still works the same way because you go to the bank and the bank is not, you know, dealing out $100 bills. The bank is dealing out, but they're going to be doing the same thing I was doing. They're going to be, when that happens, there'll be a bunch of them that'll have the accounts dialed up on their screens now, and they might have a half a dozen from a half a dozen different businesses. They know where the payroll, when the payroll is. Very often you tell them, and so they're all ready for it. And they're sitting there watching your account. And when it gets close to zero, they stop cashing checks.
Wow. Well,
so
everybody, you see the
not a pretty sight.
You see the importance of having people, having their money when you're supposed to have it. And, I mean, unless you want to roll up in your Mercedes on the job and tell all of your employees that you don't have their money and they're looking at you and what you're driving.
Oh, yeah.
And, you show up on Monday and none of your employees are there.
Pretty
you know,
much.
It's best to plan. Mm-hmm.
That very often is what happens. So the trick is to plan ahead, to do a cash flow forecast ahead that is honest and straight, and you're not kidding yourself. You're not missing a whole lot of expenses, and the expenses are the ones that you'll miss. It's not the income side, it's the expense side, and you better. I always took the position that bad things are going to happen at the worst possible moment. So if there's somebody who, let's say you're a contractor and you're building a property and a payment is due on Thursday for X thousand dollars. And you're planning on that payment being what you're going to use for your payroll, be ready for a fall because that's the time that it's going to happen. And it's going to happen to you on Thursday or at Thursday afternoon at 5 o'clock. You call them up, you say, hey, where's our funds here that are due? And they say, well, we don't really have them. We're going to have to put it off until Monday. And that is a big old darn. And you probably aren't going to use the word darn because it's there's repercussions. So you not only have to have the money, but you have to have a backup plan to make sure that you have the money. So maybe what you'll need to do is you get your checks all ready to go to pay your suppliers, and if you're really that close, you might hold them. And to make sure that you have the money before you release some of those checks. I've had that happen where I had to call my people and I'd say, well, I understand we owe you, and it's due on Monday, which means it needs to be mailed here on Thursday, the preceding Thursday, but we're too close on our payroll to do that. So it's you try to give as much warning as you can, but and remember when you do that, now you're alienating your suppliers. So
right,
there's all kinds of repercussions, and the way to prevent all of that from happening is to do a plan, a business plan, a yearly business plan, and to work the plan to keep it absolutely up to date. So every Friday you take the Friday or Saturday you take the coming week and you break it down and say, okay, what are we going to do? What's going to happen? What do we need to have happen this coming week? And you make sure that you really have that hammered down very, very carefully. If you do that, then this one won't come true. But if you don't, the odds are that it will.
Well, let's say, Professor, you take somebody that's got a business and they're in a business that's kind of cyclical. You know, there are just certain times of the year where business picks up more than others. I mean, we'll just take, for example, let's say an ice cream, you know, Baskin Robbins or something, you know, which I'm sure they probably sell more ice cream in the summer than they do in the winter. But let's say this particular store, let's say they're about to open one up and it's, say, April or May. And they know that next couple of months, you know, business is really going to pick up. People are going to be buying, you know, the ice cream is going to be flying off the shelves, right? But, and they're doing this cash flow forecast with the hopes that, of course, the ice cream is flying off the shelves, and they're trying to anticipate future sales. But let's say, for whatever reason, whether it's location or whatever, that this it doesn't fly off the shelves for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe they don't have the right flavors or something, but it's just
well,
not
maybe
going
it rains. I mean, you know, we went through a 2-week rainy period where it seemed to rain every day, and it was 15 degrees colder here in Richmond than historically it was. It's been in the past. Well, you know, and you hired people and you trained people. And now you got to pay them. And you're not paying them by the scoop full of ice cream. You know, you're not paying them 10 cents per scoop. You're paying them so much an hour.
Exactly.
Or so much a week. And so then it rains for 2 weeks. Well, you got to pay them. And the ice cream that you had in the freezer is just sitting there. So what you'd done, you'd bought the ice cream on the 1st, figuring that by the 8th it'd all be gone, and you didn't have to pay for it until the 10th because it was 2% 10 net 30, so you really didn't have to pay for it until the 10th. But there it is sitting in your freezer on the 10th, and now what do we do? Well, you're going to miss your 2%. Well, heck, that 2% was our profit for the year. Well, that's gone, and so things snowball on you.
So let me ask you, Professor, about even downsizing. I'm sure that over the years you've seen it, maybe even had to do it. Because when people get laid off, for let's say, for example, you might take somebody that's being laid off just primarily because the owner or the employer just can't afford, you know, their, you know, business is slow or whatever, and they just cannot afford to carry any more employees than they possibly have to, and they just, out of a pure business decision, I mean, it's a right now decision, I just can't afford to pay you, you know, so I got to lay you off, as opposed to plan, they're looking at the future and they're projecting, you know, they're just trying to streamline the business. They figure that they can really actually get by with less employees, you know, just trying to, you know, basically extrapolate, you know, from the past and say, hey, look, we can make it, you know, we can just become a leaner company without the excess. Has it been your case that when looking at, you know, the layoffs, that most companies actually lay people off as a right now thing because we can't afford to pay you, we just have not met our projections and we have to lay you off now? Or is it really has it been in your experiences more so a downsizing thing where we're looking at the future, we can pay you now, we have your check, it's right here, we can pay you for the next couple of months, but, you know, just looking at the future, we're deciding that we're going to streamline and make the company leaner?
Well, I've seen it both ways. Where things happen. I was in the airplane business in the 1970s when the Arabs had the oil shock, and they just wouldn't sell petroleum to the U.S. And we had lines for cars. I was in the small airplane business. And the president, Carter at the time, said, well, we've got to do something, so we're going to pass an executive order that petroleum factories cannot make aircraft gasoline. And that will go to the drivers, to cars. And, you know, we didn't plan on that far in advance, I can assure you. And that was, boy, that was a big one because, you know, if you were in the air taxi business, you were in the schools, you had to supply gasoline to your airplanes, and it was not available, period, at any price. So now what do you do with your, you know, there's one that was completely out of our control. So what do you do with your school pilots? What do you do with all of that? You have that you bought these airplanes thinking that you could fly them, and now you can't fly them. So, gee, so I've seen both ways where you had a sudden shock. That was one I really remember because we had to let go. I had three locations at the time, and we had schools at each location. We had to let go all of our teaching pilots. And the worst thing was that there was nothing for them. They couldn't go next door because those guys next door had the same problem I had. Fortunately, it only lasted for about 3 weeks. When and what saved us was the ag planes also had used the same fuel that we did, and so they weren't able to spray the crops, and so what suddenly the unintended consequence of what the president did was that the agriculture industry was in sudden deep trouble. And they got it turned around for us, and then they finally said, well, hey, you know, what you're really looking at is less than one half of 1% of the petroleum products in this country were being used for general aviation. I mean, it was like it was a quarter of 1%. And so they came to their senses, but it was devastating. And we brought back some of our trainers, even though we didn't have a lot of training to do. But it really hurt me to see these guys go. That was what their life's work was going to be, at least for a while, until they built up a lot of hours and could go to the airlines. But it was absolutely devastating.
So some things you can plan for, the things that you can, and and brace for the things that you can't, right?
Yep, that's right. So what you need to do is try to build up a buffer. And if your payroll and your other expenses are, let's say, $100,000 a year, you better have a buffer out there. Because even if you're, not a year, $100,000 a month, even if you have a $100,000 account, that seems like a big one. That's going to take you through for a month.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens, there's just, when things go wrong, they often go wrong from a number of different directions. So your income gets hurt and your expenses continue. So you had planned on having some income. You had a buffer there. The income disintegrated, but the expenses didn't. And it's an old darn. We got a real problem on our hands, and there doesn't seem to be a ready solution for it. So planning ahead and trying to build a buffer and watching it like a hawk. The other thing that happens is not when a big event happens, like in the aviation industry that happened to me. What usually happens, I mean, those kind of things are fairly unusual, but what usually happens is things begin to go wrong slowly, and you don't recognize they're going wrong until things are in pretty bad shape, and you think to yourself, God, if I'd only figured that out 4 weeks ago, I wouldn't be in this shape. Well, maybe you should have figured it out 4 weeks ago. If you had kept your books up, if you had planned your work and worked your plan weekly, and you had checked your plan weekly, you would have caught this, but you didn't.
And I think, Professor, when that starts, that's when people start saying, well, I'm going to rob Peter to pay Paul.
Yeah.
You know, you know, looking at the books, you know what I'm saying? I'm going to take a little bit from over here, you know what I mean? Then I'll pay this to make sure. And then once that starts, it's over. It's downhill from there, right?
Yeah. Well, actually, the next principle is it follows right in line, because the next principle, late bill payments can cause early business failure, is
perfect
exactly
segue.
What happens. You can't make payroll. So you make payroll by not paying some bills, and once you start not paying bills, you say, "Well, they can go for another 2 days. We can stretch this to a week," and pretty soon, things are really upside down, and things have gone bad in a big, big hurry. So, but what it is, little things that usually get you, and you just don't notice them. So the way you'll notice these is plan your work and work your plan daily. What people do is they plan their work on the long term, and then they look at their plan once a month or something like that. Well, in most businesses, you can go from being in great shape to in desperate sorts in a month. And had you worked your plan daily, you figure out on Monday what everybody is going to do for the week, and then on Wednesday you check and see whether you're on target, and if you're not, why not? And if you're not, what's doing it that's hurting you? Is that something that hurt you last week, but it wasn't bad enough so to really be a worry, but it's continuing? All of that stuff requires staying up. And again, plan your work and work your plan every single day.
Can we talk for a moment, Professor, about just the relationship that an employer or a small business or an entrepreneur needs to have with their creditors or even suppliers, you know, because there may come a day where you need to ask a favor. There may come a day where you need to say, hey, listen, give me a day or whatever. If you have a good relationship, if you've built up trust, if they've dealt with you enough to know that you're trustworthy, and you do have a relationship, I mean, you know, a real relationship with them, could you talk about how important that is in business? Because there may be times when having that relationship could make or break your business.
Oh, yeah, it certainly could. It can do it with a bank. It can do it with your suppliers. The way you deal with your suppliers to build a good relationship is, in business, most all purchases by business from a supplier business is bought on the basis of 2%, 10, net 30. And what that means is you pay in 10 days, you can take 2% off your bill, so you pay 98% of your bill within 10 days. And that means that the supplier gets his money no later than the 10th day. That doesn't mean that you mail the check on the 10th day. They get their money on the 10th day at the latest. Better yet, they get it on the 9th. And you are extremely consistent on that. I mean, to the point where maybe you send the money over by special courier if you missed and you're running late, but you have to have it there by the 10th day. If you're the one who always, and I mean always, pays their bill 2%, 10, and then you have to go late, you're going to get some help. You'll also get it from the other direction. because the supplier may have a some specials, and so they'll call you. The guy who pays their bill on the 15th or the 20th or the 30th, they're going to call him or her. They're going to call
right.
you. I have a really great memory of that when I was in the airplane business, and our major supplier, we were the biggest. But when we ordered an airplane, there never was any worry about getting paid. When we ordered parts, there was never any worry about the parts. He called me one day and he said, we had a hailstorm come through here and we have 3 damaged airplanes. The hailstorm came through on like the 28th and he had 2 days to get rid of them or they would be carried over to the next month. And he didn't want mm-hmm. that. So he said, could you take one? I said, well, if you'll sell them to me at 50 cents on the dollar, I'll take all 3. And he mm-hmm. said, I can't do that. He said, well, that's okay. I mean, you know, you wanted some help. I'll give you the help, and you'll have the funds. We won't be able to get there and pick them up in 2 days, but you'll have the funds in 2 days. I'll wire mm-hmm. transfer. And we were talking then about $140,000. So
okay.
I told him, I'll wire transfer you the funds. Well, he called me back a couple of hours later, and he said, done. And that day, I just got off that phone, got on the phone to my bank, said, please wire transfer, $120,000, whatever it was, to Mooney Aircraft. And this is mm-hmm. their... Well, he already had their funds, and the guy I was on great with the bank, great mm-hmm. terms with the bank. They didn't even make me come down and sign it. They said, "Well, when can you come down and sign for this? Because otherwise, we're going to be in trouble." I said, "Well, it'd be a little hard for me to make it. I can make it after hours today or tomorrow morning." He said, "Well, tomorrow morning's fine."
Okay.
They were in trouble. The bank, if I had showed up, the bank could have examiners come down and drop a hammer on them. So mm-hmm. I was in great shape with my bank. I was in great shape with Mooney Aircraft. The net result was that we would make on each of those airplanes, we would normally make $20,000 if we sold them at full retail. We made mm-hmm. $32,000 on these. And what we did is we brought them in, we had them stripped, they filled and got rid of the dents from the hail and repainted them, and we sold them as damaged, hail-damaged airplanes, but they were absolutely perfect. I mean, nobody could see a dent in them, but, you know, mm-hmm. we represented them as what they really were. So we sold them at list less 15%, and I had bought them at wholesale less 50%.
Wow.
So I did very well, but the only reason I did well is because the supplier knew that he could call on me for a favor. Now, I didn't need those airplanes. I had plenty of inventory. But he knew he could call me on a favor, and I could perform. And the bank, I could call the bank for a favor, and they knew I would perform. I would do what I said I was going to do.
Now, question about Looney Aircraft. Now, he sold you 3 planes at, it was 50 cents on a dollar, right? And initially,
yeah.
he didn't feel like he could do that, right? I mean, initially, he was like,
right.
I can't. Okay.
Yeah.
Or was it the 2 planes, and you said, throw in the third
no,
one?
No,
he
wanted to sell me 1, and I said, I'll take all 3. Because he said he only
okay.
had 2 days to do it. He had to get his ducks in a line and get his money within 2 days. Otherwise, the Mooney Aircraft was owned by Republic Steel Corporation. They're a great big steel company. And if the planes weren't physically paid for on the last day of the month, then they got carried over to the next month, of course. And they didn't like that. Now, the insurance, Mooney Aircraft didn't get hurt because insurance paid for it. And I know what Bill Cox at Moody did is he just called the insurance. He said, hey, you saw that they were damaged. This was the best we could do. And we need for you to make it up. We've been paying insurance, and they did. So everybody came out whole on this thing.
And that was my question. I was going to ask you.
Everybody came out.
He won, too, so it was a win-win for everybody.
It was a win-win for everybody. Definitely was. So Moody came out. They got their money just like they were undamaged airplanes. That's what insurance is for. We did very, very well, and the bank did me a favor, and I was always very appreciative of that and made sure that they always had first call on the retail loans, and that's the big reason they financed me. But I didn't ask them for money for the airplanes because they'd have to have paperwork. I mean, they'd be willing to send my own money without having me sign anything for a day, but they couldn't lend me money. I knew that. It worked out very well.
Let's talk about a motivated seller for a second. Win-win, a win-win situation. If you have a motivated seller, as in the case of the person at Looney Aircrafts, motivated to sell that, you got a good deal with him as a result of him being motivated. Now, if we're talking win-win here, if a motivated seller makes a deal that he ordinarily would not make if he were not motivated by whatever circumstances that he was dealing with, that does not make the deal any less win-win, because if the person is motivated and you get them out of this bind, then that in and of itself, would you say that gives them the win that you actually bailed them out, even though keeping in mind that they otherwise might not make this deal, but just the fact that the circumstances that are there create an opportunity for you, and unfortunately for the person, although it's a deal that they wouldn't make otherwise, just the fact that they are given a lifeline, for lack of a better term, is that the win for them?
Yeah, I did that. We were with Mooney. We were far and away their largest dealer. They sold 1 year. I remember they sold 330 something airplanes worldwide, and we took 96 of them. And so they would come around three times or four times a year, one of the two, and get us to make commitments for the next 3 or 4 months. And so 1 year, I was pretty satisfied with what we were going to do. And so I offered to give them a very big order for the whole year with staged deliveries. I mean, they weren't going to send me 96 airplanes in one day, but they would, we said how many days when they would be. We had agreements on how far ahead of time we had to spec out the airplanes and decide on the colors and all of that. And I got 2 or 3% more off because he could say, well, this is a third of our entire production, and we're dealing with that a year in advance, and we believe that Geiger will do what he says he'll do. Mm-hmm. Now, I took a bit of a leap of faith, because what would have happened had I had a really big, there was a big downturn. And so I had to say, well, I hope this works out, because I couldn't see a year ahead of time. I could maybe see 6 months, but certainly not a year. But it was worth it. And it was a way that that we could make a little more and, have. And another thing that helped me is I had three locations. So if I ordered 5 airplanes for the month of May to go to Long Beach, but Long Beach sales kind of went downhill and we really didn't need 5, maybe 2 would have worked. Could I send one of them to Seattle and 2 of them to Oakland? Right. And yes, I could. So, you know, that gave me a lot more wiggle room. But
mm-hmm.
nevertheless, it. But the other thing you don't, I don't want to do, I don't ever want to do, is if you have somebody who is in a real bind, and you know they're trying to get enough money to make payroll, and they're willing to, they say they're willing to do things that are, that you know are really going to hurt them. I would be very reluctant to do that, because what I want this to do, when you make a deal like this, I want for the other side to say, hey, he's a good guy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, sure, he made a little extra. We didn't make quite so much, but we have some compensating things. So we came out, he came out, the buyers came out, everybody hit a home run here. And so
right.
I'm the good guy, and
mm-hmm.
I want to keep it that way.
Mm-hmm.
would. I never did a deal knowingly that put somebody where they walked away and they said, okay, he did what I wanted, but I was in a real squeeze, and I would
mm-hmm.
never put somebody in a squeeze in order to do that. I think that comes back and bites you.
Yeah, I do too. I do too. There's such a thing called karma. You know,
yes, there is.
What goes around comes around, right?
That's right.
Wow. Well, everybody, we're going through the book, Entrepreneurial Success, 105 Business Principles, The Road to the Top. My special guest is Professor Joseph T. Geiger. We're going principle by principle. When we pick up next time, I don't think we have enough time. We only got like 9 minutes left.
Yeah.
We'll pick up with Don't Be a Banker for Your Customers, unless, Professor, you think you can cover it.
Well, not really. We probably ought to. We probably
wait till next.
Yeah.
Give you something to look forward to, everybody. Don't Be a Banker for Your Customers is where we'll pick up next time. And that's to be 2 weeks from today. Okay, so make sure you mark your calendar. Professor comes on every 2 weeks, every other Tuesday. So mark your calendar, because he'll be back in 2 weeks and we'll pick up there. And as you can see, Professor Geiger is a wealth of knowledge when it comes to entrepreneurship. He's got a lot of examples and a lot of experiences to draw on as it relates to each principle. Professor, can you tell people how they can get the book? And I know that they're going to want to get it after hearing this show today. How can people get your book?
Well, you can do it two ways. You can go to Amazon and go to Amazon Books, and it's Entrepreneurial Success, 105 Business Principles. And you want to put all of that in there, because there's quite a number of entrepreneurial success books with that name. And if you put 105 Business Principles, it'll take you right to that one. Or you can get it from me direct, which I'd rather you do, because, frankly, I make a few dollars extra. The price is the same in both cases. And to me, it's... I went blank. You remember the, what's wrong with me? theroadtothetop.com. Boy, that
okay,
was
yes,
pretty
the road.
Dumb. Theroadtothetop.com. And that will take you where you can buy Entrepreneurial Success. You can also buy, if you're for $15, big sale here, you can get a cash flow forecast, which is a great one. It's a fill-in-the-blank type. It's made for very complex businesses or for very simple businesses. If you're a simple business, you just don't put down anything that doesn't apply.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get those too. And then there's a third product there, my latest little book, Finding a Career for Life, which is just a $9.95 book, and it's designed to help people who are trying to figure out what kind of career they ought to have, and it will help you a great deal. So often the information people get on careers, the people giving you the advice have an axe to grind. I don't have any axe to grind. I don't care whether you go to college or you don't go to college. What I do say is, if you don't go to college, these are your options, and some of them are very good. For example, you can be an airline pilot, does not require a college education, and the income is very good, and there's a number of others. There's a lot of law enforcement where the income is very good, and there you can get a two-year degree, and it'll tell you what are your best options there. A four-year degree, what's your best options there? MBA, master's, PhD, each of those categories, it'll tell you what your best options are and what's your worst. And it also will tell you how people view those particular majors and those particular careers. And some of it is very surprising. I thought that I thought that people who were really into computers would really like computer science. They don't hold it in very high esteem. Why? I have no idea. But that was a big surprise. You know, I knew that somebody who went into the ministry would like that. Somebody who became a nurse, on balance, would have a high regard for their profession. But heck, I thought that people in the computers would think that that's terrific. They don't. I have no idea why. Although when you talk to young people before they start into it, they all have a very high regard for their industry. But folks who have actually been in it for many, many years don't. And the information that's in there is from absolutely impeccable sources that do not have an axe to grind.
Well, you know, Professor, what's interesting even about that, even about the book, do you talk about the best cities? Because even someone looking at a career might say, okay, for example, one of the best careers or the best non-medical career or highest paying would be petroleum engineering. But that, let's say, for example, they lived in New York City, you know, or somewhere where the income, where the cost of living is high, then, of course, the amount of money that they're getting paid and determining whether that's a, quote, good, end quote, salary could be relative depending on the cost of living in the area that they're actually doing the work. Agreed?
Well, not only that, but if you want to be a petroleum engineer, the odds of you being able to live in New York City are poor. You might live in Bismarck, North Dakota. And if you're the kind of person who, I don't want to live in some little podunk town out in the middle of nowhere, maybe being a petroleum engineer is not for you. And it goes the other direction. If you grew up as I did in a farm in a small town, then getting a MBA in international finance probably isn't going to work out for me, because there isn't a whole lot of that in Newton, Kansas, I can tell you for sure. But there is a lot of it in New York City. And I am convinced that I would be a very unhappy camper living in New York City. So I don't care whether they'd be willing to pay me $200,000 a year. I don't think I'd want to live in a great big city like that. So that means that job pays great, but probably not for me.
You know what's interesting too, Professor, is that, and we've had this discussion on one of the shows that we've done in the past, was that even the value of the dollar today is different than, you know, years ago. So even let's take a $200,000 figure, that sounds real good, and I'll take it, okay? But it's not the same 200 of 1945, you know what I mean? It's not going to buy me as much.
We're about out of town, but I'll give you a good one on that. When I started my second business just before I started my junior year in college, and I made little tiny trout flies, and I was able to sell these little fishing flies, because they were very unique, for about $2 a piece, and I could easily make 10 of them an hour. So I could make $20 worth in an hour. My cost of materials might have been two. I don't think it was, but it might have been two. So I could make $18 an hour. This was in 1958. The purchasing power of 1958 dollars today is $158.
Oh.
That's inflation.
You talk about
so,
it.
Wow. So, and the purchasing power of $158 today back in 1958 was 18. So 18 doesn't sound like a lot, but back then when bread sold for about 20 cents a loaf and gasoline was 18 or 20 cents a gallon, $18 an hour was a lot of money.
I can imagine. I can imagine.
It wouldn't be bad for a college kid today, but back then it was incredible. You could buy a car back then, a brand spanking new car, for I think it was $1,300 for a Ford.
Wow, isn't that something?
Yeah.
Everybody, this is the experience you're getting. Okay, you're talking and listening, actually, to someone, shall I say, who's got that type of reference. Okay, that's got that type of reference point, and it's been in business longer than many people that are listening to this show have been alive. Okay, so and it's written a book, and remember, this book has got 105 principles. This isn't entrepreneurial success and 10 principles. This is 105. It's going to take more than 10 principles to get you from inception, from the idea in your head, to being a successful entrepreneur. And I'm sure a professor will agree with that. Professor,
yep.
Thank you so much for being my guest today. As always, it's a pleasure and an honor to actually have someone with such a wealth of experience to be on the show and to share your wisdom with my listeners. Thank you so much for agreeing to be my guest today.
Thank you very much, Juanza. Bye for now.
All right. I'll talk to you soon, all right?
Yep.
Take care,
bye.
Everybody. My name is Juanza. His name is Professor Joseph T. Geiger. Make sure that you get the book. Go to theroadtothetop.com. That's theroadtothetop.com. Get Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top. Make sure you put in, if you're going to get it on Amazon, make sure you put in the 105 business principles, okay? You want to make sure, because, again, as he mentioned, there are a lot of entrepreneurial success books on the market, but make sure you put in the 105 business principles, because you want to make sure that you get the right copy. And, again, if you want to get the autographed copy, make sure that you go to roadtothetop.com, as well as you can also pick up the cash flow forecast, which, of course, you're going to need it. That's, not something that is optional. I mean, you can try to make it without the cash flow forecast, but that would be like trying to sail a ship without a compass, okay? So make sure that you get that, okay? Everybody, my name is Juwanza. Thank you so much to all of you entrepreneurs. Listen, you can do this. All right, sometimes some things seem daunting, especially when you're first starting out. It seems like, oh my God, can I do it? Yeah, you can do it, but there's going to take study. There's going to be times when you need a guide, okay? There's going to be times when you need a compass, because a lot of things can come up. A lot of unexpected things can come up, and a lot of unexpected things do come up. So you just want to be as prepared as you can. You want to stack the odds in your favor. Remember, the more you know, the less you don't know. Okay? So if I were you, I would get the book. Actually, I've gotten every edition. Actually going to get another edition tomorrow, okay? So, again, I want to encourage you to get this book. I've read it several times, and the principles are not just for business. They're also principles for life, too. It's Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top, 100 principles, 105 business principles for business and life. Okay, you'll see when you get the book and you read it, you'll see. And I guarantee you that you'll recommend it as well. Okay, so until the next time, everybody, my name is Juwanza. Professor Geiger will be back in 2 weeks. Comes on every 2 weeks on Tuesday, every other Tuesday. All right, so make sure that you're back with us for the next class. All right, until the next time, everyone, thanks for tuning in. You could be doing anything, but you decided spend the afternoon with my person and Professor Geiger. So until the next time, all you entrepreneurs, stay positive, okay, and get the book. That's Pooh.